It is No Filter Sports this edition, May 18th, 2020. Eli Zarrett here in Bloomfield Hills, Bob Bage in West Palm Beach, and Denny in Pickford, Kentucky. Pickland?
Pikeville.
Pikeville. Piccadilly, Pikeville.
Pikeville, Kentucky.
All right. Where'd that come from? Pitland, Kentucky. Where did you get that?
I don't know.
The last time I said something bad about Kentucky, it trailed me for 35 years, and I'm not saying anything bad about Kentucky.
Okay, don't do this to our listeners. Yeah. What did you say? Tell us the story.
Oh, what I did an article in one of the major newspapers across the country, and I talked about my first introduction into professional baseball, which was in Harlan, Kentucky, and I threw a no-hitter there. Well, I wanted out of there so bad because we had literally no running water, and we were on the fourth floor of a hotel without an elevator, and it's July. I mean, it's only 140 in the shade. And I made a number of comments in this major article, and then I started getting one piece of mail after another, including from the sheriff. And almost 30 years later, I ran into that sheriff at a show in Washington, D.C. He said, "Mr. McClain?" I said, "Yes, sir." He's, "I got a warrant for your arrest." And I said, "Where are you from?" He said, "I'm from Harlan." I said, I didn't do anything in Harlan." He said, "Yes, you did. You said a bunch of bad things about us in a newspaper article. We want you to come back and defend those."
Well, that's 1962. And for the last, whatever it is, 60 years, you continue to put your foot in your mouth. So you got off to an early start.
That hasn't changed. Now, I'm sure no one in Harlan, Kentucky is without a gun. Did you get death threats over that?
I got all kinds of threats. Yeah. Believe you me, I got them all. I don't know about gun. I don't recall some of that, but it was, it was a fun place. You know, the one good thing about it is, and I was only, remember, now, I was only 18 at the time. And Sharon and I weren't together at the time. And lo and behold, there's one thing I learned about the 400 or 500 girls that lived there. And I'm talking about young, long ladies, you know, 18, 19, 20 years old. They all had a deal for you. It had to do with cooking and taking care of your children if they could get out of Harlan.
Did any of them have all their teeth?
I'm not going
there,
Bob.
That's not fair. That's not fair. That's not nice.
Hey, I was born in Kentucky. I can say whatever I want.
Yeah, go ahead.
Well, then you go ahead, and I'll give me your address.
I got a confession.
Uh-oh.
On Saturday, in the clandestine act, I met a hairstylist in his garage. We both had masks on, and I got
a haircut.
Oh, my God,
you did get a haircut. I'm looking
at
you.
I got a haircut. Oh, yeah. Man. Of course, I played. I paid black market prices.
Oh yeah,
worth every bit of the $40. Anyway, people are getting out. It's a bit shocking to watch the news and see crowds of young people now at restaurants in Texas and New York. This is Monday, and the stock market is beginning to soar as the appearance of opening things up. Of course, we don't know what's going to happen once things are opened up. Already, some infections seem to be on the rise in certain places, but
Eli, let me interject by saying that Florida, as you well know, is different. We are open for business. Most of the beaches are open today now to the public, and the rest will be open a week from today, Memorial Day, as we speak. We went out to a restaurant, a place we like to go, an upscale place in West Palm Beach, Friday night. It wasn't packed, but there were a lot of people there. Nobody was observing social distancing, and not one person in that restaurant had a mask on.
Did you have dinner inside?
Yes.
Oh, my goodness.
People were sitting at adjoining tables as if everything was just the way it used to be.
It's a whole different thing. It's a whole different thing down here.
Yeah.
Well, I'll say this about Kentucky. They're still locking you out of the restaurants. You can get a pickup, of course, but you still have to order ahead of time and pick up your food when you arrive.
Yeah, we just don't know what any of it means. So that's the whole problem. I mean, you can mitigate your risk when you fly in a plane, you drive in a car, you know what the odds are, you know it's infinitesimal the chance that you're going to die in the car. The problem here is we really don't know how deadly it is, even for all age groups. We know it's worse in certain cases, but you can't quantify it the way we really would like to quantify it so that you know what the chances are. I would sit in a restaurant too if I knew what my odds were, but we don't, unfortunately. And that's one of the problems we have here.
And on the other hand, the good news is that we had a great race with NASCAR this weekend and also the golf. Both were very entertaining, especially the first lap of the NASCAR race when a couple of guys didn't get out of the starting box. which reminds me of when I was with a company in Michigan years ago. We sponsored a car in a NASCAR race over at the Michigan track. And lo and behold, they start the gentlemen, start your engines now. And boy, you get all excited. You're starting to sweat. You're waiting for your car to take the lead. Our car didn't make the first half of the first lap on the exercise lap. We never got a go.
Well, can I throw a little bit of levity into this, or a lack of levity into this, I should say. I enjoyed.
No, come on, we're on a roll. I want to hear you talk about the golf, Eli. I didn't watch.
I watched the golf.
Not very exciting.
I enjoyed the golf. It got a little bit exciting at the end. But you see, we're talking about sports as a distraction, as an escape. And you got from everybody from Scott Boras to the president to whoever else, and it goes across the board, saying sports is an important part of our culture. It's an important part of our lives. It's the healing. It healed after, you know, World War II, and it healed after 9/11. I kind of disagree. And the reason is because it's not sports yet. When I'm watching NASCAR drivers with masks on, when I'm watching Rory McIlroy carry,
did they really have masks on, the NASCAR drivers?
Yeah, sure.
Did they really wear masks?
Excuse me, sir. Calm down. Before the race, they did. When they got in the car by themselves, they didn't. So you have the NASCAR guys, because they were, you know, everybody's, leagues and these owners are, and these commissioners are trying so hard to make it work, and it's just a sense of futility to all of it, and that's why I applaud the effort, but it wasn't real sports. Especially the golf. They're the trappings of tournaments, prize money, point standings, rating for majors, watching great stars play, new stars being born. I appreciated this kid, Matt Wolf, hitting two 360-yard drives was remarkable, but there's no stakes. There's nothing on the line.
Yeah, I know that, but I still got questions for you, Eli, about this stuff, because I didn't watch it. And the reason was, you know, I heard they were going to do this Skins game, and I wanted to see where it was in Florida. I found out it was a Juno Beach, like 25 minutes out my house. Right. I thought, you know, well, that's going to be a great, I go to a PGA Tour event every year anyway. I'm going to go see that. And then, of course, I read the article and no, I wasn't going to see it. So I have no interest in watching it on TV. But for both of you guys, Eli, you already addressed the first question I have. How good a player is this 21-year-old kid, Matthew Wolf?
Oh, he's going to be a player. I mean, listen, this kid hits the ball. He strikes the ball consistently all the time. Between the four guys, by the way, they raised $5.5 million for the nurses, for the Nurses Association. So they got a bunch of money from this
That's
little
good.
Exhibition.
Well, but, I mean, but how good a player? Do you guys, can you tell? How good a player is this kid going to be?
Listen.
He's going to be a real good player.
He won the NCAA championship with his team, Oklahoma
State. Thank you.
He won a tournament by sinking an eagle last year to win the 3M tournament. So he's got great potential, but who knows? A lot of guys win a tournament early on. That's not the issue. The issue is that.
The issue is this. How did Tiger look?
He didn't play.
I thought Tiger was supposed to play in that.
No, he's playing in the next one. He's playing in the next one.
Okay. Who played? Phil then? Did Phil play?
No. No,
That's another one they're doing.
McIlroy and Johnson.
Well, Rory won it, I know. Yeah.
Will you stop talking and we can tell you? You're just rambling. It was McIlroy.
No, you're rambling. I'm trying to ask you questions.
Are you done asking? I can answer now.
No, I have another question, too.
I am happy. I am gay. Jeez. I am your mailman.
Dustin Johnson and Rory McIlroy took on two former Oklahoma State stars, Ricky Fowler and young Matthew Wolf, and they raised $5 million. Point is, it didn't really matter. It was exciting because McIlroy, they had a playoff. You had to get closest to the pin because they had $1.1 million in unresolved skins, and Wolf got within 18 feet. This is a driving win. McIlroy got within 13 feet. They won the money. But it didn't matter. It was the same amount of money. There's no points. There's no, you know, final standings. It was nice, but it's not an escape because you're acutely aware. Now, when you read a book or you watch a movie, you can descend into that and you can escape for a minute. But when you got to sit there with a mask on watching people with masks and people social distancing, it's not sports. It's some type of contrived, and I don't blame any of them. It's contrived BS to do something, and it's better to do something than nothing. But it isn't like sports returning, and the same thing with the, now the NASCAR race. I didn't watch all of that, but there was a lot of, you know, some crack ups, and Hartwick won, and he's the top guy in the business. But you know, it's not the same.
Okay, and, well, you've made that point over and over again. So back to my questions.
But let me ask a question of you two.
Go ahead.
So they played this at Seminole, which has never hosted any kind of a pro event before, and people referred to it as an amazing but an unknown course. Unknown? I've never heard of it in my life. It's 25 minutes from here. It's up by, you know, Jupiter Island, where Tiger lives and Jack lives and all those people. What did you guys think of the course?
I thought it was wide open. You could land a 747 on it.
Yeah, it's flat. It doesn't have the same view like those seaside courses in England and in Scotland and Ireland.
Right.
But a lot of sand and a lot of water to make it difficult. But I can see why they don't hold events there. The thing about it, though,
they want people to score well. And television being used for the first time, more or less, this year, after all the hell we've been through so far and more is still to come, people want to see birdies, they want to see eagles, they want to see people play very well, and they got their taste of it yesterday.
Yeah, it was. If you're a golf fan, like Bob isn't, he didn't find it.
I am a golf fan. I try to tell you that. Just because I don't play doesn't mean I'm not a golf fan. You know that, Eli.
You didn't even know who won the tournament last year.
Gary, and you're wrong about that too. Gary won the U.S. Gary Woodland won the U.S. Of course, I knew who he was. I just said it was kind of a fluke thing. So now you're going to tell us all how many events he won since then.
Not many.
This reminds me, the whole thing reminds me of the great W.C. Fields line. The lady is upset because he's drunk. And he goes, "Well, lady, when I wake up tomorrow, I won't be drunk, but you'll still be ugly, okay? I woke up today, we're still in quarantine, and nothing has changed, even though I watched a sporting event yesterday." So,
That's for you. Nothing's changed.
UFC is back, and again, I applaud them all. But this baseball thing, when I get into the baseball thing, it's so hard to imagine them pulling it off that I almost wonder whether it's even worth trying. Of course, they have to try, but these commissioners have never had a more difficult challenge in their lives when you're doing something that has no precedent, that has no history, and you don't know how it's going to turn out. It's totally unpredictable. I feel for all of them. The NBA seems to be somewhat close, and they all are behind their commissioner, Adam Silver, who's a great leader, having taken over David Stern. The difference is they're all together on this. If the NBA figures out a way to do it reasonably safely that they're comfortable with, the baseball thing, though, is imploding, and this is very, very ugly.
Until they get over the revenue thing, and right now the players are demanding 89% of the revenue, and that's all there is, by the way.
No, they're not demanding 89%. They're
just
saying we made a deal, and the owners.
It's on the table right now, 89%. I just read the article an hour ago.
The two of you, with your lack of information, is driving me crazy.
Well,
the owners claim, that if they don't get a greater reduction, the players will wind up making 89% of what it is. That's their claim. It's part of a negotiation. And the point is, it'll be a lot. It'll be more than 50. They claim they want a 50-50 thing. It'll be more than 50 to the players because of what you're alluding to, the costs of putting it on and everything. But the problem here is that the players are being perceived as greedy and not just taking what they can get. Isn't a couple of million enough? And the point being is that if you may die, they're saying, no, it isn't enough.
They always have. They've always been on the bad side of negotiation here because for some reason, a lot of fans don't believe that they're supposed to be entitled and they're not supposed to ever walk out on the game. Listen, this is all to do with contract law and something that somebody signed, somebody agreed to, and they don't now want to agree to it, the owners, that is. And sooner or later, you know, well, let me back up one second. They've got all these new rules, too. You can't spit. Think about this. A baseball player, football player not being able to spit. No spitting, no handshaking, no arm bumps, no group hugs. Here's the best one. I want to see
how they do this. No showering at the stadium.
No showering at the stadium. But here's the best one.
You're all going to get COVID-19 and die.
But wait a minute. Here's the best one. Spacing in the dugout.
Funny. Yeah.
Social distancing in the dugout, yeah.
I want to see that one.
I imagine you sitting there with Johnny Sain in 1968, one of the greatest pitching coaches who ever lived, draping his arm as he did around Dennis Dale McClain and saying, Denon, I want to tell you something about, son, what you're doing out there right now. He's, oh, don't touch me. Don't come near me, Johnny. Right. 6 feet social distancing. So, Eli, A, I did not make any comment about what's going on in baseball, right? And B, let's test your knowledge, Mr. Smartass. You ready? What do the following three former Detroit Tigers pitchers all have in common? Doug Bear, Kip Young, and Jeff Jones. Okay, bet you guys don't know that, so you strike out, Eli. These
they were all relievers. That's one thing.
Okay, and have they got something to do with the virus?
They were all righty.
Actually, it does, and I'll tell you what.
All right,
tell you what. So these MLB pitchers are part of the same group that those three Tigers are in. Oral Hershiser, Roger McDowell, and Burke Badenhop. Every one of those guys, former Bowling Green players. And late Friday came word that Bowling Green, with that great little baseball program, has now eliminated baseball, effective immediately, a money casualty of COVID. But did you see the Detroit papers? Zero new COVID deaths all last week reported in Detroit, and only 11 in the entire state of Michigan. Still, Eli, as you know, Michigan may not be open for quite a while.
Well, as long as it works, we keep moving forward.
Yeah.
If it works. So Whitmer's under tremendous pressure, as everybody knows now. To me, the highest holy day of the year is the Michigan-Michigan State football game. And to think that she's saying that, well, we might have football, but we're not going to have any fans there. Michigan-Michigan State playing its annual game with nobody in the stands.
Well, you can't put that on Whitmer, because that's what it's going
to
be.
Sure, she could open a stadium if she wanted to.
Yeah, Bob,
sure, you can put it on Whitmer.
Bob, everybody's got a TV. Got a TV or
come on. I'm not watching on TV if there's nobody in the stands.
Oh, you're not.
Gonna be no fun.
You're not. Yeah.
Because it's a scrimmage. Wait a minute. A scrimmage then.
Just 1 second. You know what they should do then? Do what Green Bay is going to do. They're going to pipe in the fans, the booing, the cheering, the running. They're going to pipe in everything. That'll work.
And so what's your solution?
All those little plastic dummies in the seats throughout the stadium, 120,000 of them.
Eli, we've been over this.
Please rescind the question. Your solution probably is to let 100,000 people show up.
We've been over this a million times. I'm not going to go there.
Hey, here's something else we've been over. David Hall and Hall Financial care about the community, and the team at Hall Financial is working from home to help you save money by refinancing. It's a great time now to look at your refinancing options. If you haven't done it in the last year, now's the time. Lower your monthly payments. Keep some extra money in your pocket. You can refinance. You can probably skip up to two payments. Don't worry about the coronavirus. Homes can be appraised without someone stepping foot inside. They drive by and do an appraisal. Their service is the fastest in the business. That's why they have nearly 1,500 five-star reviews from Michigan homeowners. It takes just a couple of weeks. Go to the webpage, get started, or call 248-308-5000. That's Hall Financial. Lower payments, better options, more personal attention. You're listening to the No Filter Sports Podcast. I agree with you, Bob. A game without fans is not the same thing. Just like when Rory McIlroy carries his bag, it's not the same thing. When you got to interview a NASCAR driver from 8 feet away and you both have masks on, it's not the same thing. But if they can actually play a football game and figure it out and get players to play, it's better to play the game with no fans than to not play the game at all.
And okay, so that's your opinion. But I want to mention this, though, about COVID and college football, which, again, may be shut down, at least in the state of Michigan. Bye games, I think you guys know what they are. Mm-hmm. Bye games are essential to the bottom line for non-Power 5 athletic departments. But the ongoing risks of coronavirus shutting down the start of the season is beginning to worry administrators like Arkansas State Athletic Director Terry Mohajer, who told the Associated Press last week that his budget would take a major hit if the Red Wolves September game ready for this? I'm sure you knew this. At Ann Arbor against Michigan is canceled. He said, quote, but I would think that as much as this is going to hurt us, it's going to hurt Michigan too. I would imagine they make $15 to $17 million per home game. Our game against them is not as important as winning the Big Ten, but our game from a revenue standpoint is just as important to the University of Michigan as if they play Purdue. And money, money, money. Yeah, it's just, sure. It's going down the tubes, man. I hope it doesn't complete the journey, but it's just going down the tubes.
You know, we've said it 1,000 times in this show, follow the money, you'll get all the answers.
Yeah, well, baseball claims it would lose $4 billion, and I believe them. They got paid debt on their what they borrowed for their stadiums. They've already agreed $170 million in salaries. There's all kinds of expenses to maintain the ballpark and everything like that. So the pressure is really on the owners as well as the players, maybe even more so, to open this up. Of course, the owners have deeper pockets than the players. But the problem is, and we're going back a little bit here, and Buck Showalter said over the weekend, fans don't want to hear complaints. And the big one that really made national news was Blake Snell. And one of the problems was he says it like, bro, you know, like, I'm not splitting no revenue. I want all mine, bro. You know, y'all going to be like, bro, Blake, play for the love of the game. He goes, listen, and this is about, I quoted this doctor from U of M, as a matter of fact, the epidemiologist, with coronavirus, we don't have good quantification of risk. And this is true. He says it feels like it's pretty dangerous sometimes, and other times feels like it may not be a big deal. And I'm the same. You know, I got the hair. I didn't worry about the haircut. I put the mask on. Who knows? What are you going to do? And other times I go, whoa. So we just don't know. And that's why the players are saying, you know, listen, we're going to risk dying. Are you going to risk dying? The owners, and you know, we don't ask you to split big profits with us when they go beyond what we make. And this is where it is in reverse now. We made an agreement, 50-50. Go on.
Okay. Well, I want to talk about another thing in TV sports, something that we haven't mentioned.
Keep it in baseball. Please keep it in baseball. Let's not jump around. Let's stay where we are for a minute or two, okay?
Okay.
I was going to ask something. We do whatever you want. See, folks, we just make this up as we go along. I was going to ask Eli, because he hasn't mentioned it the last two or three shows. I think he probably lost interest. But the final episode of the 10-part Michael Jordan series was on ESPN last night.
You're right. Grant
probably saw it. Did you guys watch that? And what were your thoughts on it?
You're right. I lost interest.
So you didn't watch the last episode.
I went hard the first six. And then I skipped seven because I recorded them both, and I'm watching eight, and I go, this is really boring. I forget which part.
Terrible.
I personally thought the first six episodes were fantastic, but yeah. I kind of died down, and I want to say that last night, which were the final two, episodes 9 and 10, I think they were the worst of all 10 episodes. Yeah. But overall, I thought that was a fantastic documentary, despite being 5 weeks long and 10 episodes, but it was a lot of fun to watch.
Well, you know, the thing about it, too, that the show is essentially afterwards, they indicating what the polls showed. And everybody knows Michael Jordan's going to win the poll. There's no question about it. And to suggest that LeBron couldn't have played in that era is crazy. You are capable of playing in what era you grew up playing in. In other words, you learn how to play the game during that era. So if LeBron was playing in the era with Michael, he would have played the same way Michael did. And listen, I don't think you can say either one is better than the other. I think they're comparable. I think they're
great. So let's not discuss it, okay?
Well, here's what got me. The thing about it is out of 600 people polled, 74%, Michael was a better player. Oh, come on.
You see, this is what I won't descend into.
Right.
Thank you, Eli.
In this coronavirus, because we got a letter. In fact, this letter really pissed me off. And I'm gonna bring it up right now.
I got it here somewhere. I'm gonna bring this up right now,
okay? Because I get upset. The letter is from.
You get upset with the mailbag to begin with all the time.
I'm upset.
I'm just upset with this.
I think
a lot of people want that to be our theme song, right? So Dom Vitale wrote this letter, a long-time listener, here in Palm Beach County. He says, well, this is actually true. He said this before to us. He's been a loyal listener since day one. Might be time to hang it up. The interviews are good, but the constant rambling and reviewing the same topics from week to week during this coronavirus has shown a lack of creativity. Nothing really but love and good luck to you guys. Just an honest outlook. I mean, really? We talk about the same topics on every show. It's just COVID-19. The COVID-19 thing is the lead story on every show everywhere, but the circumstances and stories change show to show.
Yeah, that was a Dear John letter that really pissed me
off. Oh, Dom's coming back. Dom's coming back when this thing blows over.
Call me stupid. Disagree with me. But don't call me uncreative. I've devoted my career, to trying to take a story and look for an interesting spin on it. Have it make sense. Give it some perspective. That's what I'm trying to do here. And to say constant rambling.
Okay, we love you. Everybody loves you. Everybody
really
loves you. It's all good.
I'm just saying it.
They know. They know. Calm down. Eli, it's all good.
I think what Mr. Vitel is talking about is the pandemic anyway. And I mean, if 87,000 people dead don't get your attention, there's nothing we can do for Mr. Vitel to stir his interest.
All right. We're running through the mailbag, unfortunately, ahead of time. And Denny wanted to mention this, so I'll bring it up to him now. Ron from Mount Clemens sent us a great note featuring a link to a Sports Illustrated article that I had not seen. Because of COVID, Prince Fielder may end up the highest paid MLB player this year. He was forced to end his career in 2016 due to that neck injury, but formally retiring would have meant Prince would have to forfeit his salary. So because the injury was deemed career ending, Fielder and the Texas Rangers, who you'll recall foolishly sent Ian Kinsler to the Tigers in exchange, they simply agreed that they would no longer play. And he was released by the team to avoid taking up a spot on the 40-man roster. This now is the final year of Prince Fielder's contract, and he's going to make $24 million.
It was a $214 million contract.
That's a lot of money.
And I remember Mike Ilitch at the time. We discussed this at the time. And his point being, Ilitch's point was, we're still competing for the championship. We had lost 30 home runs and 110 RBIs when Victor Martinez got hurt. I believe it was, the 2011 season?
Yeah.
2012. And so you go in the free market and you say, well, what is it going to cost to get 30 home runs and 110 RBIs? And the only guy available was Prince Fielder. So the cost was $214 million. And he did. He gave him 30 homers and about 110 RBIs. Unfortunately, he did it for 1 year, and they were stuck with the rest, unfortunately.
Yeah.
But you know what? Before we go, okay?
Where are we going?
I'm just going back to Dom Vitale for a second. Because he says, maybe you three are just a bit out of touch. And this is what's key, and Brandon helped me here. He says, it's affecting the other shows at this point on a behind-the-scenes type of way. I think he's referring to the Red Shovel Network.
That's blasphemy. That's blasphemy. He can rip us if he wants. But you don't bite the hand that feeds you, and we would be nothing without Drew Lane and his largesse and allowing us to use the Red Shovel Studios. Go there.
That's not what he's talking about.
Eli, stop your dog from barking.
I'm not talking about that, Bob. Hold on a second.
This is live. This is we do this show live, folks. Well, and you may be listening to the recording, but we do it live.
Good boy. Just won't get it.
And let the record right indicate here that neither of my Frenchies has ever barked once during the history of recording this program.
He's kind of accusing us of infecting Charlie LaDuff's show. Hold on a second. Hold on a second.
Hold on for a second. Wait a minute.
Well, Denny, let's you and I talk for a minute. Yeah, then we'll let Eli go take care of the dog.
One of my good friends at one time got out of the hospital yesterday. Art Howe, who was third base.
Yeah, I'm glad he's okay. Yeah,
and in fact, he played third base when I owned the Memphis baseball team. He played third base for us up there. Good guy, and became a manager. Of course, he's done very, very well. And I was really sad to see that he got so sick. But he's on the mend. He went home yesterday, which is very, very good.
Well, Danny, speaking of famous Houston Astros, as Art Howe was, I know you saw the terrible news that Bob Watson died over the weekend.
Oh, yeah. I sure
74,
did.
Former Astros slugger, the Bull, two-time All-Star.
He's been sick.
He had kidney disease. So he was the first Black general manager to win a World Series in baseball history. He did so with the Yankees in 1996. I covered him, his time in New York. Just a really good guy, sound guy, honest guy, friendly, approachable, and we're going to miss him. I do have another measure of good news besides Art Howe being on the mend. I want to wish a happy 83rd birthday today to a guy Danny will call and we'll have on with us soon. One of the finest men I ever knew in sports, and that would be Brooks Robinson.
Ah, good man. Today.
We almost lost Brooks to cancer a few years ago.
You don't have to tell me. I know all about it.
And, can I take a radical shift here in topics?
Permission, yeah, go ahead.
Permission requested.
Well, if you want to disrupt the show, sure.
My dog already did it.
Oh, he's back on the show now. Oh, no, look.
Right.
What happened?
Ladies and gentlemen, we want to introduce a new guest. Eli Zara.
No, we had the window guy. I don't think there's nobody. The window guy was doing the window by the front door. Anyway, Phyllis George died. Okay. Mm. Phyllis George died yesterday at the age of 70 or Saturday, maybe. And, you know, she's being lauded, deservedly so, for being the first female to kind of break the glass ceiling when she was hired in 1975 in the NFL Today. She was Miss America in 71.
Be nice.
And Bob Wussler, who was the president of CBS Sports, recruited her to be part of the NFL Today. She did a pretty nice job along Brent Musburger, Irv Cross, Jimmy the Greek Snyder. And the point is, she did pave the way for other women to be sportscasters, which her daughter Pam said. But the point is that she was in the rarefied air and protected by the big network, and she did that job kind of cut off from the rest of the world. The real woman who changed it in sports reporting was Melissa Lutke, who in 77 sued Bowie Kuhn for barring her from the clubhouse when the Yankees were playing in the World Series. She sued him, Lutke versus Kuhn, and won based on her Fourth Amendment rights. And she's the one that opened the doors for women to get into locker rooms. Phyllis George, no disrespect, I think she did a very nice job, was in the rarefied air of the network and didn't have to rub shoulders with athletes in locker rooms and force her way in. And I tell you, I was there at the time when this happened, and it was ugly. And Ann Doyle was the first female sports reporter in Detroit to venture into locker rooms. And she was treated horribly, especially by the Detroit Tigers, who called all women that came in. And I think you all know who might have been the ringleader here. I want to mention his name because he's a...
It's Gibby. It was Gibby, and I was there. When I was at Channel 7, I brought an audio woman, a professional, into the Tigers locker room. Mm-hmm. She was assigned to my crew, as you said. It was perfectly legal for her to be in that locker room. We walk in and Gibby says, "All right, you guys, there's a slit in here. Everybody cover up." Now, I looked at him and I said, "That's one of the lowest things I've ever heard say before, pal."
They used to call them DWs. Dick watchers is what they used to call them. And I thought it was ridiculous. It was the opposite. These women went out of their way not to be caught peeking. They didn't want to. But I do have a funny story, because that year in 78, Sue Dice was a camera woman at Channel 4 at the time, and she was there for many, many
years. She red-haired girl, wasn't
yeah,
she?
Yeah, yeah, yeah.
I knew Sue. Yeah.
We talked about this many times. And, you know, back then, it was the cameraman, and you had the sound person had the port-a-pack. So the sound person would put the port-a-pack on the ground, because the player would be sitting down, the reporter would be sitting down, and she would be, you know, kneeling on the ground with the port-a-pack, getting the audio levels right. And John Long, after a game, and they didn't call him John Long for no reason at all. And as he's sitting in his chair.
What do you mean, Eli?
As he's sitting in his chair, below his towel, almost scraping the floor, is the end of his. And she turned to the right just inadvertently and did one of the greatest double takes I've ever seen in my life. And we joked about that for many, many years. But no, I'm just saying, I'm giving credit to Melissa Lutke, because she's the one who was on the front lines, and she's the one who really made
it. So then I know you're going to tell us now that men, conversely, are allowed in WNBA locker rooms, right? It's only fair, Eli. You know that.
Yeah, they aren't, are they?
They are. Well, of course they're not.
Can I say something about Phyllis George?
Go ahead.
I knew her rather well at one time. Saw her a lot of dinners, a lot of functions and what have you. She's one of the nicest people I've ever met. She went through a hell of a divorce at one time and married another guy who was, I think he owned all of
them. She married the governor.
And the governor.
Yeah. She got divorced in 98.
She had a nice life, and she was a nice lady. All I can tell you, she was a nice lady. I never saw her out of control at anything, not like you two lunatics.
Yeah.
And she would never take a conversation where you guys have just taken the last couple of minutes.
That's right. And that begs the question. I've met a lot, and so have you, a lot of nice ladies in my life. And I've seen some beauty queens in my life. What right, by what lunacy do they have to be on television talking to us about sports? They don't know anything about sports. Phyllis George was on TV just because she was a beauty queen, and that opened the door for the rest of the hot.
How can you say this?
Why is it?
Are you? Was she a big sports fan? Oh, she was.
Let me ask a question. Uh-huh. Let me ask you a question. Why would a 25-year-old lady who's a beat writer be any less qualified than a 25-year-old man when neither of them ever played high school, college, or professional sports?
I'll answer that question for
you. Why would the woman be less qualified?
I'll answer that question for you. Because you and I started collecting baseball cards at 6, and we were playing the game by 5. Our entire lives were sports. And I don't know about the specific reporter you're talking about, but they have taken so many of these hot chicks because the empty seats who program the networks. They think that we males want to see hot chicks reporting on sports when we want to see guys like Danny McClain in front of the microphone who played the game. Who know what they're talking about. I don't want some woman telling me something like that. Oh, I want guys who played the game. I have no problem. Look, I love Doris Burke. I really do. And I love Candace Parker. But they were great basketball players. Who's more knowledgeable than they are?
Wait, Eli. I've sat back here all morning listening to you guys.
I didn't play anything.
Listen, right. And you couldn't because you had no talent to play anything. But here's two items.
He made his high school baseball team.
Come on. Jim Hawkins and Rich Shook. Did either guy have less ability to barely walk, much less write anything about
they
baseball,
grew up as
football,
wacko
basketball?
Sports fans.
I don't care what they grew up as. Fans. They still didn't know anything about
it. They have the knowledge.
Bob, they didn't have the knowledge.
How do you know the women don't? How do you know Angelique Chengalis wasn't a football fan her whole life?
Now you're in modern days.
I can't
comment on her.
I am going to finish. These women work twice as hard as we do to put a show on and be a part of an operation. They were
BS. Where did you get that?
I'm telling you, I know they do.
I Bob, I agree with you about vapid sideline reporters who are beauty queens. But it's the role more so than them, because a lot of the men do the same garbage also. I was a sideline reporter. And I worked it very, very hard. I had stories. I had interviews. I had all kinds of stuff. I didn't just say, hey, coming out of the locker room, Coach Smith says we got to really bear down on defense and we got to stop their running game. Otherwise, they're going to pile it up against us.
You know what?
That's not reporting.
I totally agree with what you just said about yourself. And you were a great sideline reporter for the Pistons. So why didn't they hire you at the network level to do the NBA game of the week? Because you're not a beauty queen. That's okay. Why you didn't get that opportunity.
But don't knock the ladies for being beautiful.
I'm knocking some of the ladies, not all of the ladies. Okay. Don't write letters, folks.
Okay, we got enough of that.
Oh, boy.
Sorry I brought it up.
Oh, I got one for Denny here, too, because we're talking about deaths in sports over the weekend. So Mike McCaskey, the chairman of Denny's beloved Bears, died at 76, cancer. Yeah, the son of Virginia McCaskey and, of course, the eldest grandchild of the great, the legendary George Halas. So Mike McCaskey had a whole big hand in the Bears front office across decades. Denny, do you blame Mike McCaskey for the Bears' problems recently?
I don't blame anybody for my Bears problems. My Bears problems have had a number of problems since the middle, late 80s, and I'm a Bear fan, and you guys know that, and I'm not going to blame anybody there because I think I'm getting Mr. Rodgers for a quarterback before the season starts.
You're crazy.
I am so happy. I am so pleased. I am so optimistic about
this. You're high is what you are.
Who knows? I could be high. In fact, I'd like to get high. I guess I got to talk to Eli about that. But
the problem is you don't get high enough.
That's right. But I'm going to tell you, I read a big article over the weekend. He is pissed. He's had enough. And he's sooner or later, if it's not this week, it'll be next week. I think he's going to ask to be moved and be traded to the Bears.
I don't believe
if you're Green Bay, you're not trading him to your most bitter rival in the same division, Denny. Get off it.
Look what they did. Look what they did when they drafted this kid. Why did they do what they did? No one's figured it out yet.
Wait a minute. Time out. Go ahead. Time out. They did the same thing in 2005 when they selected Aaron Rodgers and Brett Favre was the incumbent. And for 3 years, Rodgers watched Favre. Rodgers understands it. He said, my general reaction was surprise at first, but I'm not going to say I was thrilled with the pick, but he understands that Love didn't ask to get drafted by the Packers. They're doing their job. They're doing, but why is it that it's only with quarterbacks? They're so protected.
Those are the stars.
What if they had drafted an offensive lineman over a guy who was a starter for 5 or 6 years? What if they drafted a defensive back? It's only when it's a quarterback that we make these huge, oh my goodness, Eli, what does it mean? Oh, Eli, they're going to get rid of him. No.
Eli, it's like pitchers for the most part are guys who hit home runs. Their romance is in production. The romance is in the guy with the personality. The romance is the guy that can throw touchdown passes. And this guy has been as good as anybody's ever been. So everybody's in love with him.
He's got
Eli, I'm sure you know that other than perhaps a goalie in hockey, quarterback is the single most important player in all of sports. Now,
another reason why you have to have a succession plan. Now, it used to be where they assumed it would take you at least 3 years for a quarterback to get ready. Now you got guys like Mahomes and Lamar Jackson. They're ready faster because the role is has changed. They can make plays happen with their legs when the scripted play isn't there. But you still need time for most quarterbacks.
Well, of course.
It seemed like a simple, wise, forward-thinking draft pick. This Jordan Love, it's going to take him a couple years. I just really don't get why they're making such a big deal.
My Mr. Rogers from Green Bay, who's going to go.
They're not trading the division.
Let me finish. My Mr. Rogers, who's in Green Bay and soon to be a Chicago Bear, all right, says he's going to play till he's 42 or 43. We got plenty of time for the other kid to learn how to play the game of football. Now, Bob, get back on your bike and go play with your dogs.
You know what I'm going to do?
Yes,
I'm going to ask. I'm going to ask Eli to send me some of that bomb stuff he sent you that you've been smoking this morning. Guess what I'm going to do?
Hey, for nearly 20 years, Luke Nowacki has worked with individuals, families, businesses, people like you and me to help you gain clarity on your financial situation, and really so important today, gain some peace of mind about the future. That's what I respect about Luke Nowacki. He makes sense, and he will look at each situation differently depending on your particular situation. At Pinnacle Wealth Strategies, where he works, you will get a complimentary consultation. He'll answer all your financial questions. He'll put you on track to be ready when you retire or when your kids get married and go to college and have all that ready for them. So give them a call at 248-663-4748. We need to have our financial future and our financial goals lined up. So I should call Luke Nowacki of Pinnacle Wealth Strategies again, 248-663-4748. Advisory services offered through Royal Alliance Associates, other marketing names, product service reference here, independent of Royal Alliance Associates. This is the No Filter Sports Podcast.
I got something for Danny. So when you go back home to Illinois, you see all kinds of people because the Bears are, as we know, just such a popular team in Chicago and elsewhere. They got their little Chicago Bears license plates. And I think most states now make those license plates. You can put the logo of any of your favorite sports teams on them.
Right.
In Michigan, for instance, I'm not sure why anybody would want one, but you can pay extra and get a plate with the FL's logo on it. So. Yeah. Listener Todd Faber tweeted me a photo he took in traffic of a guy driving somewhere in Metro Detroit the other day. He asked the driver his permission to use the photo. The man agreed. This driver's personalized license plate had the Lions logo on the left side, and the plate read, #4VERBAD, forever bad.
Okay, you set it up and you teed it up for Denny, you boy. I tell you, you're
all right.
You're that was your car? That was your car?
Oh, is he ready to go?
Matthew Stafford this weekend said, I love being a Bear, a Lion. A Lion. He loved to be a Bear. He loves being a Lion. Would he rather not win? That's my question is, because he's had broken bones, back issues, arm issues, and all else. And he says nothing about winning in this wonderful article they wrote, this self-adoration article. Why doesn't he talk about winning? What is he going to do to make this a better football team? Because they've always put it on his back, and we haven't seen. The only thing he can say in his defense is, well, when I'm not playing, they were 0-8 last year. Oh boy, that's exciting.
All he can do is play as hard as he wants to, and there's no way, there are things beyond his control. The same thing Aaron Rodgers said, there are things that you can control and things that you can't. And he wants to play until he's in his 40s. He's 36 now, so he'll keep on playing. If it's somewhere else, he'll play somewhere else, and he probably will when he's later in his career, like most quarterbacks do, including Tom Brady.
But I was going to thank
and Joe Montana, other Hall of Famers.
All the other quarterbacks that you're talking about, that's what I was going to bring up. All the other guys, you know, the Mannings and guys like that, that, you know, they wind up with another football team because they want to win. I wouldn't want to stay here in Detroit if I've got an opportunity to go somewhere else. And you know what? There wasn't anything wrong with picking up this kid, Tua, either. I mean, I'd have grabbed that kid.
Well, you can't expect, you know.
So Eli and Brandon, two sane people here, voices of reason. Can't you just see the amazing headline in the Chicago Tribune? Aaron Rodgers leads Bears over Packers in NFC Championship game.
Wow.
It's not going to happen, Denny.
Hey, by the way, Bob, we never mentioned who our guest is today.
Yeah, have not.
Coming up is a wonderful man who I really enjoyed in his years here in Detroit, grew up here, is Jimmy Carson, who had a fascinating NHL career. Not as great as anybody thought. His first 3 years, in fact, he was the greatest teen hockey player in history. Scored more goals than any other teen player.
There are only two teenagers in the entire history of the NHL who scored 50 goals in a single season. Mm-hmm. One would be Jimmy Carson. The other would be named Wayne Gretzky.
Mm-hmm. He's the only, and only two Americans ever scored 50 goals, at least to that point. The other one was Bobby Carpenter. So he had a, but yet, and yet, his career did not end the way it started. He was a different sort of guy. Jimmy Carson was not a standard beer-drinking Canadian hockey player. And I wonder, I'm going to ask him whether his lifestyle, he was a clean liver, whether that clashed with other players.
Okay, but remember this, Eli. When he was unfortunately traded to Edmonton, ironically, in the big Wayne Gretzky deal, Jimmy tore up his knee. He really tore it up. Yeah. And his big skill was his amazing skating. He had lost a step or two after that. He was never quite the same player.
Oh, yeah. Significant.
So you talk about the NFL. I know Denny saw this.
They're open. What's up?
They're open.
Oh, yeah, they are.
Tomorrow.
Facilities
and, open. And the guys are back to their usual. Arrest warrants were issued Thursday after we'd finished recording the show for two players accused of armed robbery at a cookout they attended near Miami the night before. I'm very familiar with, my beloved Giants starting cornerback DeAndre Baker. The other one's name is Quentin Dunbar, who's a corner with Seattle. They get this. Did you see this? They allegedly robbed other guests at the party at gunpoint and left with thousands of dollars in cash and wristwatches worth tens of thousands of dollars. Both charged with four counts of armed robbery. DeAndre Baker charged with four counts of aggravated assault. He's out on bail right now, but he's not going to play for the Giants this year. Now, remember, Giants GM Dave Gettleman traded up in the draft to take him in the first round last year. Some analysts said he was the best corner in the draft, did not play well last season. How much vetting of Baker did the Giants do? Now, remember the guy who was also said to be the best defensive lineman in last year's draft, Ed Oliver out of Houston, wound up going ninth overall to the Bills. He was arrested over the weekend for drunk driving and, of course, carrying a gun in his car. Redskins wide receiver Cody Latimer arrested over the weekend after shots were reportedly fired outside an apartment where he was. I mean, are they concerned about the image at all of this league? And do they vet these guys?
That's not my question, because I can't do that. My question is, the first two guys you mentioned ripping off the party.
That makes no sense.
Isn't part of committing a crime that you should at least think you have a chance of getting away with it?
Otherwise, there's no point
in committing a crime if you can't get away with it.
They were all wearing COVID masks. Nobody recognized them. They all had COVID masks.
That's what I was going to say. Who's having a party right now? Jeez, I haven't seen too many parties out there.
Can I say so? I walked into my bank about 2 weeks ago, and I had the mask on. And I walked in, and I know these folks at the bank real, real, real well. I walked in with the mask on, and I said, "Hold up, I need all the money."
No, did you?
Oh, absolutely. Geez. And everybody turned around and looked at me and said, "Denny, what do you need?"
Denny, did you enjoy living where you used to live on a couple of different occasions in your life, Denny? And at that point, I think that was the end of the conversation, right?
What the hell is he talking about
now?
I can't even imagine. Two times in your life you lived a certain place, and now you're walking into a bank with a hold-up thing going on?
It's a joke.
Well, it's a joke. Yes, Denny. It was a joke.
Yeah, the first two times wasn't a joke. This time was
It was not.
Anyway, we have to get to Jimmy Carson pretty soon. Why don't we jump on that ever-exciting Joe DeSanto mailbag?
Okay, we can do that. I got another interesting story for you if you think we have time for both. We got time for both.
Do we have to? Go ahead.
I just thought this was really cool. The Detroit Free Press reported Monday morning, and they actually may have gotten it from the New York Daily News, about the Brooklyn Nets' Spencer Dinwiddie. Now, I know you remember him. Second round draft pick of the Pistons. Never even gave him a chance. Traded him to the Bulls, even up for the immortal Cameron Bearstow. Bearstow couldn't even make it in the NBA. He was playing in Europe at last word. Since the Pistons stupidly traded him away, Dinwiddie has not only established himself as one of the NBA's best point guards, he's a very bright young man, describes himself as, quote, a tech guy with a jumper. Last September, Spencer Dinwiddie attempted to convert his three-year, $34 million contract extension with the Nets into a digital investment. Now, that's, you know what that is, right? This Bitcoin stuff. Yeah. The NBA rejected his plan, citing collective bargaining agreement rules. On Friday, Dinwiddie, who's now a free agent, announced a GoFundMe campaign himself.
Didn't you miss an element there that he was going to involve fans and make it kind of a fund? He's allowed to do anything he wants with his money. He can take his $34 million and he can buy a pile of dirt in the backyard. But if you're going to engage fans and make it like a mutual fund, you can't do that.
Okay. And then speaking of fans, what you're talking about, his GoFundMe for the fans now has a goal of $24,632. That's 2,625.8 Bitcoin. Now, if Spencer meets that goal, he's going to allow fans who contributed to choose where he signs for his next free agent contract. If he falls short of the goal, he's going to donate the money to charity. And I read in the New York Daily News just this morning, it's not going too well so far.
No, it's not going to go
By the way, Bitcoin's way up there, right? I have nothing to do with it. Don't quite understand it, but it's like $9,300 or $9,400.
Guys, right, I have to say goodbye to radio right now. KWCWA and WDFN, thank you for listening. You have been listening to the No Filter Sports Podcast. Okay. It's very clever what he's doing. But by the way, your first point about the Pistons trading away, was that as bad as the Chris Middleton deal? I think maybe we should. And you see, this is what sports shows are reduced to now. The five worst trades in Team X history.
We didn't say that.
The seven best defensive linemen in Bears history.
I know.
But that's why that pissed me off, that letter from Dominic Vitale. Like, we should be doing that crap. The 74 for every year in the NBA, blah, blah, blah. By the way, I thought it was a really sobering article that bothered me over the weekend when the story about Kobe's death. And what bothered me so much is that they died instantly.
Yeah.
But it revealed that they plunged 4,000 feet.
Yes.
So it's one thing to die instantly. It's one thing to know that you're plunging 4,000 feet, that you're going to die instantly. And I'd hoped that I thought they may have just run into the side of the mountain and died instantly, which would be better than that agonizing way to go. And that was a very,
you know, once
awful,
you
awful story,
you stall
awful.
You stall an airplane's bad enough, you stall because an airplane's got some wings on it, but you stall a helicopter, it's like a rock.
Yeah,
and it's going straight down quickly.
When that happened January 26th, that's what you said the next day, is that it stalled, and apparently the guy did not have any alcohol in the system.
Right.
And it was
and nor have
an
they
accident.
Found they didn't find any mechanical issues yet.
Yeah. Yeah.
That's to the mailbag then, right? That's what you want to do?
Mailbag. I am happy. I am gay. I come only once a day. I am your mailman.
Fade to black. There you go.
So thanks to that, which was brilliant, by the way, when you did it the other day, we'll lead off with a not awful mailbag who tweeted, love the hilarious talk of adopting a theme song for the Mailbag Thursday. Although Denny's version was a little blue. So I thought about that, Denny. Now, we don't want to get slapped with one of those podcast R ratings for using swear words or blue material. That can limit your audience. So, Dennis, can you, like, I want to test your ability to improvise musically. Could you sing that mailbag song, mailman song again, and clean it up as you go along? Go ahead.
Sure.
No.
Sure.
Clean it up.
Not right now.
No.
That's what I asked you.
He just did. He said, I come once every day. Okay. That's not that dirty. It's a little double entendre.
It's a double entendre.
That's it. All right. Next,
all right. Here we go. To the mailbag. And of course, a lot of the comments to start with are about the Jim Abbott interview. You can tweet any of the three of us, not guaranteeing that Eli or Danny are going to answer you, but you can if you want. At Eli Zarrett. At MU2Denny, and I guarantee you I will answer you unless you use vituperative language, and that's at Bob Page Sports. Dale Philhart says, Jim Abbott is another one of my favorite dudes. You guys are knocking these interviews out of the park. Mike Wiseman, way to go, No Filter. Jimmy was a best. And he made us Flintstones proud. I played for Flint Northern against Jim Abbott and Flint Central. And I remember him no-hitting us. Are you ready for this, Denny? I remember him no-hitting us and striking out 18 of the 21 guys.
It's a pretty good day.
Mike says, I popped out to shortstop, and it felt like I got a hit. His stuff was nasty.
Nasty Kirk Kuzmowski. Strikeouts. By the way, nasty is also 17 strikeouts in the first game of a World Series.
Bob Gibson.
Yeah, Mickey Lolich was a hell of a pitcher, wasn't he?
Yes, he was.
All right, Kurt Kuzmowski says, great interview with Jim Abbott. I'm surprised that Eli or Bob, who always do great research, did not ask Jim about playing quarterback for Flint Central High School. I think he led the team to the playoffs. How would Jim Abbott be able to take snaps from center with one hand? And Bob, I often scramble for the dictionary when you talk. What is bifurcation or something like that that you said recently? Well, Kurt, I mean, everyone knows that bifurcation theory is the mathematical study of changes in the qualitative or topological structure of a given family, such as the integral curves of a family of vector fields and the solutions of a family of differential equations. So glad I was able to teach Kurt that. But Eli and Demi, you're that
too. Yeah, I love people of average intelligence trying to sound really smart. So next item, Bob.
I resemble that remark. I'm a magna cum laude graduate of Big Ten University.
Oh, stop it.
So am I from my elementary school.
Yeah, that's right. Yeah.
I'll print you, Bob, I'll print you a new one in an hour.
And catch you to see Eli, 69 or 70, attending classes at his beloved alma mater, the University of Michigan. He somehow is able to find the class to begin with. Mm. He walks into the door, looks at the prop, and says, oh, wow, man. Like, this is such a gas, just like being here, man. You would have graduated from Michigan Magna.
I was a kid. I was at a meeting on Friday, an outdoor meeting, by the way, so that we socially distanced properly. And the son of the guy at the meeting was a sophomore at Michigan. I go, are you the class of 2022? He goes, yeah. I go, you're 50 years behind me at Michigan. 50 years. Okay, keep going.
Paul Hibbert, regular listener, writes, I don't get the rush on opening sports. Why? $33 million out of work? Who's going to buy tickets? If given their druthers, I'm sure buying food, paying for rent would be the priority. And our regular contributor, Gaspar Genovese, added, really interesting conversation you guys had last show about whether people need sports. That may have been one of my favorite shows yet. I go to the supermarket, bank, hospital, etc., and I see staff working there in conditions worse than athletes would face when they go to work every day. I recognize we put sports stars on a pedestal, but why are we more concerned about their health if they do their jobs than all the other people out there? I never thought I would ever type these words, but I agree with Bob. If there is one segment of society that doesn't have to worry about dying from the virus, it's pro athletes. They're younger and they're healthier than the rest of us. If so many other folks still have to go to work, why not pro athletes? Please help me understand what I'm missing.
Time out.
The key word is have to. If I needed the money, I'd be a 70-year-old who had to go back to Lowe's and be a greeter and get my $12 an hour. I don't have to go back. That's the difference. Athletes don't have to go back. Some of them may if they're young and they need the money. Others don't have to. And that's the difference. So, yeah, we don't know how dangerous it is to go back. And maybe some of them have to have a certain amount of money to be assured they aren't going to die. That's why I'm not going to go back to work. I would if I have to, but I don't have to. And I'm going to wait till there's more information and I'm more certain that if I do go back to work, whatever that would mean, that it would be safe. So that's the answer. He's right. They are young. They don't have to worry about dying that much, but they don't have to do it. Okay.
Let me tell you what I did the other day down here in Kentucky before I had my pork ribs. All right. Jeez. Go ahead. I got me a.
You ate the ribs of a pig? Why would you do something like that?
Stop, Bob. Stop.
Oh, Bob. Don't do this.
No, you stop, Eli. I'm going to call him on it every time.
Oh, Bob, I had the virus test done the other day.
You know,
okay? And I got to tell anybody who's thinking about having the test, it's a little scary at times because they come at you with this great big stick. And they stick it down both of your nostrils.
Yeah.
So I just want to let you know, be prepared for that because it is scary. But I will also tell you this. soon as you get through, you want to use the bathroom right away because, man, it scares the poo right out of you.
All right. So this is from one of our website submissions. You can email us, asknofilter@gmail.com. Michael Wellhausen, Bob, Danny, and Eli, I want to thank you all for a great show. We've been over this before, so we won't spend too much time on this, Michael. With all the emphasis on a pitcher's velocity now, I was curious about what speed was Danny's fastball in his prime, and also who was the pitcher with the highest velocity that he saw during his career?
Well, it was the guy that we played against was Sam McDowell. I don't think anybody threw the ball harder than Sam. But the guy that we all saw pitch once in a while was a kid in the minor leagues. What's it, the left-hander?
Steve Dalkowski.
Steve Dalkowski. And he could throw the ball. I mean, he just had no idea where the hell it was going. I mean, I never thought I'd see anybody wilder than Joe Sparma. And, I mean, Sparma one night threw two balls up on the back screen. That's wild. And Dalkowski was just all over the place, just everywhere. So
you chopped out in the mid 90s, right? You did, you never threw 100.
Mid high 90s is what
seriously, when did radar gun, was the, they have radar guns when you
No,
played?
They had radar guns, but not for baseball. What they had was some kind, they brought what the heck is a company in Saginaw, Michigan up there, the big one that been in bankruptcy for 30 years. I can't think of the name, but huge technological company, and they brought down a whole bunch of equipment to test guys who could throw the ball relatively hard. They tested about 7 or 8 of us that day. And I was 97, 98 at that time. So You never know. It might have been off 20 miles an hour for all we know.
All I got to say is if you've never played baseball and you get a chance to stand in against a major league pitcher, anything over 60, you can't see.
Yeah,
so it's a little different.
Different
for those guys where a mile an hour makes a difference.
You know, I ran to one of the great guys who ever played for the Detroit Tigers a number of years ago in Phoenix, where he lives now, Jim Whalewander, and we just BSing. And I said, "So what was it like facing Clemens in his prime?" Whalewander said, "The first time I was at bat against him, he delivered a fastball to me. I really did not see it. All I did was I heard it hit the catcher's mitt. I couldn't even see it. So there has to be some kind of an adjustment there."
One time in spring training, most of the players had left and Jack Morris was still there. I think Lance was too. Maybe the bullpen catcher was there. And I said, "Just throw me a forkball. I want to see." He was reluctant, but I said, "You know, I'll stand at the edge of the batter's box so you don't make a mistake and hit me in the head." He threw me a split finger pitch. Was probably what, 90?
Yeah,
and not only was it 90, which is like a blur, but then it dropped at the end. I said, "There's no way. There's no way that you can hit a pitch that like moves like that. How is it even possible?"
That's what a forkball does. A good forkball dives straight down at the part where the hitter is standing.
How do you know where to swing? Is it a different?
Listen, you think the pitcher cares?
I think a lot of these guys, Eli, what they do is if they see a forkball, they lay off it because they figure it's going to break down out of the strike zone, won't be called a strike. Just don't swing.
That's, Bob, what they do, the good hitters, until they get two strikes on them, they look for a pitch. And if a guy's number one pitch happens to be a real good forkball or a curveball, whatever it might be, they will sit there and wait for it to be teed up for them until they get two strikes on them. That's the way the good hitters hit 300. That's the only way you can hit 300 is if you have some kind of an idea what's coming on the next pitch.
1959, 18-1 throwing a forkball.
Elroy Face.
Yeah,
Believe it. Elroy Face of the Pittsburgh Pirates, who later became a carpenter in upstate New York. His guys weren't making the money they do now, that's for sure.
But also in 1959, another lefty threw 12 2/3 innings of perfect ball who played
Harvey Haddock's.
Same team, the Pirates of Pittsburgh.
Mm-hmm. And we had Elroy Face here for a short time, by the way.
No, I think Harvey was with the Reds when he did that, Eli, but we'd have to look that up. Anyway, back to the mailbag here. Not much longer, Eli. Don't you worry about it. Just sit tight. We'll be finished with this.
Yeah, I got to be somewhere Saturday.
Our regular Alan Kopech wrote to say how much he loved the Jim Abbott interview. The rest of it was kind of personal to me because it turns out he went to high school at Detroit Catholic Central with my late son-in-law. And Alan, just thanks so much for the info and the very kind words you said. You guys can call us or leave a message. Text us, 760-89-BALLS. And here's one from Greg in Clinton Township outside of Detroit. Eli, he has an excellent question. One I asked you myself quite a while ago, but you were very tepid about it, so I just never followed through on it. My bad. Have you guys ever thought of interviewing hometown boy from St. Martin's, Jim Essien?
I know Essien. I haven't thought about interviewing him. I didn't think he's a big enough name. Nice guy.
I'll tell you this then about Jimmy. I saw him just a couple of years ago at the Tigers annual alumni golf outing that you sometimes take me to if I'm in town. Jimmy played 11 years in the big leagues. Mm-hmm. Now, St. Martin's was a small Catholic school on the east side of Detroit where Jim Essien may have been a better football player than baseball. Era just assumed he's going to Notre Dame. He graduated in 69, but Jimmy said no. So it came down to Duffy versus some brand new coach at Michigan named Slim Blickler or a German name like that. Essien then shocked Michigan State by signing with Bo. He went to team orientation, everything, then just decided he'd rather take the signing bonus money and play baseball instead. And Eli, Jim Essien, never left Detroit, is now the manager of that team you went to see and told us about, the Utica Unicorns of the United Shore Professional Baseball League.
Are you telling me you prepared something on Jim Essien here?
This guy played 11 years in Major League Baseball.
Well, that qualifies him to be.
How many years did you play in Major League Baseball?
10.
And Jim played 11. I think if you ever make the major leagues, you were a great baseball player.
Yeah.
So anyway, it was very nice of Greg to write that about Jim Essien. And he says also regarding teams coming back into stadiums and arenas, as we discussed in this show, how are they going to distance people 6 feet entering and exiting? Also, he says, I would think they're not going to allow drinking. I have no idea where he got that info. It is our right as Americans to pay $12 for a beer at big league sports events and $18 for a tiny watered down mixed drink. No bars. You guys heard that? They're not going to have any bars.
Yeah. Is this the mailbag?
Yeah. Okay.
The mailbag's now over, Danny. That'll make Eli very happy.
It's over. It's over. It's the, my goodness, enough already. By the way, I'd like to thank Alan Kroll, donated $100 to our cause.
Thank you, Alan. Thank you very much.
And by the way, we do have a recurring donation button, and it seems like, all our heavy hitters have already donated because there hasn't been anything new in the last 3 or 4 days. But if you can throw a dollar or two or three so we can pay our expenses next month and recurring, that we really appreciate that. And just go to the donation button on our webpage. Let's talk to our guest today, Jimmy Carson. What do you say, boys? Okay.
Good idea.
Well, Detroit's Jimmy Carson played minor hockey with CompuWare, went on to play 10 seasons in the NHL in 88. He became just the second teenager in league history to score 50 goals in a season. The first was Wayne Gretzky. But including Gretzky, Carson scored more goals as a teenager, 92 in fact, than any player in NHL history. And at 19, in 88, his second year in the league, he tallied 55 goals, including his historic 50th against Chicago on a breakaway against goalie Darren Pang.
Hits with a long pass breakaway. Jimmy Carson looking for his 50th. He shoots, he scores! U.S.-born player to score 50 goals in a year, the second teenager ever to score 50, the second youngest player ever to score 50.
What a time that must have been. Now at age 51, he joins us. Long time, Jimmy. Great to talk to you.
That can't be. I met him when he was 18 for the first time. He's 51 and has lost a lot of his hair.
Well, that happens to all of us. How you doing, Jimmy? Great to have you join us.
I'm doing great. I'm glad to be with everyone. And that was a nice memory I just heard. I haven't heard that in a long time.
Yes, that was a long time. You're 18 years old. That's way back in 1988. You know, let's start at the beginning then. You grew up in Detroit. You're a hockey star here. You played for CompuWare as a kid. You're 18 years old, and the Wings have the number one pick in the draft, and they take Joe Murphy, and you go number two to Los Angeles. Now, there's reasons for that because the Wings were pretty set at centerman. They had Adam Oates and they had Steve Yzerman at the time. Were you disappointed, and had you thought you might get drafted by the Wings?
If you remember back that year, the Jacques Demers was the coach, and the Red Wings were not doing well at all, and Joe Murphy was at Michigan State having a good year, and then I was in Montreal. I had kind of followed Pat LaFontaine's footsteps. To answer your question, I was hoping that the Red Wings would draft me, but they were pretty clear, you know, Jim Devolano and whoever else. They didn't make it a mystery that they were going to select Murphy. So I guess I was holding out hope that maybe the hometown kid angle would would rule the day, but it didn't. And I went to LA and really didn't know what to expect, but it actually was great to be selected by the Kings there. And I went in with a complete open mind. I'd heard some negative things. LA is not a hockey town. And then it became a very good experience.
It's 1988. The season is over, the season, and you are part of the biggest trade in NHL history. Going to the Edmonton Oilers for Wayne Gretzky, McSorley, and Mike Krushelnicki, they throw in $15 million. Was it a crushing
three number moment? One draft choices too?
Yeah, you're right. I mean, the price was out, was incredible. What was that like? Did you see that coming, or did it take you by surprise?
In order to properly frame that and address that, I got to backtrack just a little bit. So as you mentioned earlier, I had a really good season my second year, and the team was on the upswing. And Luke Robitaille and I were rookies together along with Steve Duchesne. And there was a lot of buzz in the Smythe division that the Kings have three young guys and that they're going to build and maybe make a couple strategic trades and that they're going to start being maybe a force in the division and see where it goes. So the season ends on a very high note in the sense that we actually lost to the Oilers that actually, no, I'm sorry, it was my rookie year we lost the Oilers. But anyways, the Oilers were the creme de la creme. Wayne Gretzky was Wayne Gretzky. So the season ends, and Bruce McNall, the owner, who had developed a bit of a friendship with myself and Luke Robitaille, he comes to me as soon as the season's over and says to me, I want to renegotiate your contract. He says, you and Luke are the staple, and Steve Duchesne, are the staple of this organization. We're going to build it. He had just bought out Dr. Jerry Buss's share of the team, so he was the sole owner. And he's like, you know, I want to renegotiate your contract right now. This is like in June.
That's actually maybe a little, whatever. That's great.
We start talking about that. And then he says, oh, now go buy a house. And I'll never forget this. I'm in his office, big, huge office. And he's like, my wife, Jane, is an interior decorator. She'll help you decorate the house. So the owner of the team tells you to go buy a house. You have a very good season. You got a good rapport with, you know, your teammates, et cetera. And you got a young team on the upswing. So that's the mentality I had when I'm coming home. And I, by the way, I did go buy a house and I did outset it in Redondo Beach, and which is where most of the players live. So that's the mentality I had coming home to Detroit, Grosse Pointe, for basically 2 months in the summer. I had been gone, you know, obviously, you know, the training camp, and then you go through the whole year. And then, so I'm coming home for a few months and then I'm going to go back, get ready for training camp. So anyways, that's my mentality coming home. So right around late July, so I'm excited. We started to renegotiate a contract. You know, it's going to be great. Right around the end of July, I get a call from Bruce McNall. Back then, there's no cell phones and there's no texting and there's no internet. And you just, you know, completely off my radar screen as the fact even a trade. So he calls me at the end of July and he says, hey, how you doing? How's the summer going? Oh, training hard, getting ready. He says to me, hey, I got some really good news, but there could be a wrinkle. I'm like, oh, what's the good news? He's like, we might get Wayne Gretzky. And I thought he was joking. I said, what do you mean you might get Wayne Gretzky? Like, he says, in a trade. He says, it would be amazing. And I'm like, oh. So, and then at the time, then he goes, I said, what's the wrinkle? He goes, they really are pushing for you because they need a centerman to replace him. And they like the fact that you've had a good start, et cetera. So I was just blown away. I remember just telling him, I said, oh my gosh. I said, well, you
How
know,
about
that
house?
Kind of like silence on the phone. And I just said, well, do your best. Keep me out. I'd love to play with Wayne Gretzky and I'd love to stay in LA. And Bruce, you did tell me to buy a house and told me to renegotiate, you know, and I was just like, holy tamale. So I hung up the phone and I remember telling, it's not every day the owner calls you. So I remember my parent, hey, what? I said, oh, that was the owner, Bruce. And he says, what's up? And I'm like, oh, come on. No one's going to trade Wayne Gretzky. Are you kidding me? That's just unthinkable. He's like a legend. I think my dad made a comment growing up in Detroit. He's like, that's like trading Gordie Howe in his prime. Like, it's not going to happen. So, okay. Didn't think much about it until the actual day of the trade. I got a call early in the morning, Bruce McNall again. And I could just tell right away when I answered the phone by his voice. He was kind of like hemming and hawing. And finally, he's like, Jimmy, I don't know how to say this, but I couldn't keep you out of the trade. You've been traded. And I said, is it went the Wayne Gretzky trade? He goes, yep. And so, I mean, I could see, like, in hindsight, it was probably, I'm not going to say he was sad to tell me, but he was certainly, you know, he just kind of, it wasn't just business.
Jimmy, how'd that work out for you in Edmonton? They loved you immediately, didn't they? And nobody was pissed that Wayne Gretzky was traded away.
You scored 49 goals. They must have said, this is great. We got a new Gretzky. Worked out great, didn't it?
The other thing, too, Bruce makes all kinds of implied promises.
Yeah, well, that's true. So I was shell-shocked when this came down. And then, of course, the other part of the being shell-shocked of like, okay, you're going to Edmonton. You know, the first thing I started seeing on TV and stuff was like, you know, the Parliament of Canada will not stand for this. This is a betrayal of the national interest. There will be an MP putting a bill in Parliament to rescind the trade. This is an international incident.
Yes.
And I'm like, oh. So it was very, very, it was just a difficult situation. And then on the flip side, it was like a massive party starting in LA. It's just like, that's all everyone was talking about. And it was like the media went crazy. And you think, well, you were right in the middle of it. And now you're completely out of it. Now, the one thing I will say that Bruce did tell me at the time, he said, don't worry, Jimmy, I'm going to try to get you back, which I think, okay, well, so it ended up happening. But anyways, but that was a whole different,
He's alluding to the fact you scored 49 goals at 100 points in 89, but obviously it wasn't good enough. So was life there unbearable? Here you are replacing a legend, having a great season, but it wasn't good enough, was it?
You know, I've had decades to think about it. And trust me, I don't think about it that much anymore, but I used to. First of all, the players on that team were some of the most amazing players ever in the history of the National Hockey League. And I look back at having played with Mark Messier, Glenn Anderson, Grant Fuhr, Yari Curry, Kevin Lowe, Charlie Huddy, you know, just some amazing, amazing players. So when I first got there, it was, I think they respected me as a player. It wasn't like I had just come in the league and not really had done much. So I think they did respect that. But these guys grew up together. They won Stanley Cups together. They, you know, some of them broke into the, you know, from the WHA into the NHL together. They took the city of Edmonton and, you know, they called them the City of Champions. That was their motto for a while, kind of like Hockey Town in Detroit. And they had this persona, this whole brand, and it was led by Wayne Gretzky, and he's now gone. Like, they were in mourning.
Yeah.
How could anyone do this?
Jimmy, this had nothing to do with you being good enough. This had all to do with Gretzky. I mean, it really.
Yeah.
Period.
Yeah, for sure. You know, he was a legend. He is, you know, and you think back statistically what he was doing at the time. It was, you know, it was amazing. I'm sure everyone's been watching this Michael Jordan Last Dance documentary the last number of weeks. I have. And, you know, it's like trading Michael Jordan after he'd won a fifth championship. Who's going to do that?
What was it like when Edmonton played against the Kings after that, Jimmy? Gretzky comes back to Edmonton. You go back to L.A. Did you guys ever exchange any words about the deal on the ice?
Very minimally. So it's interesting you say that. So back then, the Smythe division, we had, well, I mean, the whole NHL, but each division, you'd play each other eight times a year. So we went to LA four times. They came to Edmonton four times. At first you go, you know, at least for me, I'm going back to my house. I'm like, oh, I got this beautiful house in Redondo Beach. You know, I've spent three nights in it. So I'm like, okay, I'm going to spend a night in my house. But then, you know, you're just one, two nights there. You play the game. So, but you know, it's, you see all the same people that you had, the guys in the press room and this guy and that person. And, you know, you knew everyone and they all knew you and they were excited to see you, but you were the opposition. It wasn't the same. And same thing when Wayne came to Edmonton, you know, all the players were going out with Wayne before the, you know, whatever. And it wasn't like a bad thing. It was just, he's their buddy. And of course the media was very intense, especially in Edmonton when Wayne would come back. But if you guys may not remember this, we played them in the playoffs that year, and we were arguably a better team than we had a very good team and we were playing well, not Wayne Gretzky well, but well. And we played the Kings in the playoffs that year. And we were up 3-1, we as being the Oilers. And then the Kings came back and won. It was, you know, kind of like Disney fairy tale ending for them. They were up 3-1. And then Bruce McDowell, at the time, he brought Ronald Reagan in the room to give him win one for the Gipper speech. And they came out. And that was a big story at the time. And then he had just been, you know, he was no longer president. And, of course, they beat us in games. They beat us, you know, the last three games and won the series. I think they ended up losing the next round, but that was a major kind of.
Yeah. I got two quickies. Number one, did Bruce ever renegotiate your contract, which we don't know yet? And then secondly, did you get a hell of a price for the house?
Well, the answer to the first one was no. We were in the middle of it. God. And that was one of the reasons why I ended up leaving Edmonton, which I'm sure you'll probably ask me about at some point. But
here's the next question.
My sister, who had moved out, we're, you know, nice conservative family from Grosse Pointe, and my sister suddenly says, I want to go to L.A. My brother's out there to go to school. My parents are like, what? And then find this wall kid, your brother's out there. So she moved out to L.A. to go to school there, and suddenly she's like, oh, I can stay in your house for while you're in – and so my sister kind of, so anyways, I kept it for a number of years and then I ended up selling it. So
you demanded so you play the one season and you lose to the Oilers in the playoffs. You have 49 goals, have a great season. You play with some great players as you mentioned. And then you demand a trade at the very beginning of the next season and come here. Was it a contract thing? Cause it seems like things are going okay in Edmonton, at least in terms of your career and playing for a great team.
Yes. So it was a combination of a few things. Number one, it was a real cultural shift for me. And it, not that alone, you know, it's pro sports. You go where they tell you to go. But it was the whole aura of the Gretzky trade and, you know, being an American and being in that spotlight. And then you couple with the fact that, you know, I had some meetings with Peter Pocklington, who was the owner at the time. And he had called me in during the prior year and when, you know, the 49 goal season. And he had said to me, we see a long future here for you. And we want you to be part of this program or this organization for many years. We would like to renegotiate your contract. So he was like a 7 or 8 year deal. And it was way below kind of market. And I'm just like, well, this is nowhere near what we were. Well, you got to understand it's Canada and the Canadian dollar is a lot less. And this is just the way it's going to be. And you're going to have to accept it. And there's really not much you can do. You know, this was a whole different era in the NHL. And I was like, well, I'm not sure that that's going to be right for me. And he kind of inferred, well, you know, if you play your contract out, the only way that you can have a lot of success here is, you know, you got to get power play goals and you got to be on the power play and you got to do, get a lot of ice time. You got to play with the right players. And, you know, if that doesn't all happen, you may not have numbers to do that. So I think it's in your best interest to sign this. And I'm like, I'm just like, oh, I'm kind of learning big league sports quickly. I thought about it over the summer and I'm just like, you know, I came to training camp and at the time, Glenn Sather was the coach and GM. Glenn Sather had stepped aside. He went up to be president. And I had a really good relationship with John Muckler, who was the co-coach for a number of years, and he took over. You know, all of a sudden training camp started and it was going pretty good. And then there's like a number of games went by and I was barely getting on the power play. It's just like, what did I do? And then it was kind of brought up again to me that you really should sign a longer term deal. And then I just like, you know what, that's kind of the end.
But Jimmy, then story. You walked out on the team for four games and that forced your trade back home to Detroit. Do you regret that now?
You know, sometimes I do, sometimes I don't, but I can't change it. So I can only really analyze what I was thinking at the time. I think that if I had stayed, I would have had a very good career. And I think the team was a very good team. I just don't know at the time, you know, just the frame of mind of being there is a constant, you know, I can't believe, and by no means am I using this as a crutch, but the constant Gretzky's gone. I can't believe it. Pocklington's horrible. He's got to sell the team. He breached the, you know, I even heard stuff like he breached the fiduciary trust of this organization by selling a national treasure. You know, just, there was so much swirling and negativity. And then you're like, you know, kind of financially, what's that going to mean? And so there was just a lot of factors that go into that decision. It was, you know, at the time it was very, very controversial. And this was kind of before players had more, little more leverage or whatever. Mm-hmm. And it was, but it was more of a principle thing for me. I just like, you know what? I think it's best for me to go. So,
well, and you came back here, which was, I guess it was fortuitous. I don't think you had a demand where you're going to get traded to. You play here a half a 90, 91, 92, and a half a 93. Of course, you're a centerman, and you got Steve Yzerman and Sergei Fedorov. You did score 100 goals playing for Demers and Murray. You got hurt at some point, I think, really. Didn't you have a knee injury?
In Edmonton.
Yeah.
Hurt his knee.
Yeah. Bob, you've got a good memory, or you did your homework. Yes, I got my – so the third exhibition game, I got a freak injury and ended up, you know, tweaked my knee or whatever, and it was in Calgary, and then had to take a little time to rehab it, et cetera. And so I was very excited to come to the Red Wings. There was a lot of hoopla on that, coming back home and this and that. But, you know, I had some injuries. I got this and that. But, you know, that I loved, being home. And it was kind of the precursor to the Cup Wings team, the Wings Cup teams, because we were building, you know, we won a couple of President's Trophies, but then we'd flop in the playoffs. Then they brought Scotty in, and then the Hockey Town stories kind of took off to the next level. But, you know, I really enjoyed it. But back to, I think Eli made the point. Yes, it was difficult. And I remember talking to Mr. Ilitch about this. And at the time, Sergei was just a rookie. So I'm okay being behind Yzerman. You know, I just want to be part of a team, that a really good team, and this and that. But, you know, back then it was tough, that in the sense of, from a statistical point of view, they weren't keeping ice time. They weren't keeping a lot of things that now everything's, you know, yeah. It's the money ball effect on all sports, where everything's so analytical and there's numbers and data for everything. So, you know, I remember a couple of times a reporter would come and say, wow, what's going on? You only got 33 goals this year. You know, it's just, they're expecting, you know, the fans, and we're expecting to get 50. And I'm just like, well, I was trying to like politely explain that, you know what, it's a different role for me and this and that, but my ice time has really been cut back, which is okay. I'm not complaining about it. I accept that role, but I don't think 50 goals is really realistic when your ice time is cut back. But it was, you know, there was no data behind it. So anyways, I still enjoyed my time in Detroit, made a lot of friends, some great teammates and some really good teams, but we just couldn't get it to the next level.
And then ironically, you've already been traded for Wayne Gretzky. Now you're traded for Paul Coffey. The Wings send you out to L.A. You go back to L.A. What was that like for you?
Well, it wasn't the same as the first trip to LA, the first stint. So one of the things I had heard at the time was, I've heard it after the fact, that Wayne was not happy about that. Paul Coffey was one of his best friends, and he was not thrilled about that trade at all. And so Bruce, you know, I remember Bruce calling me, hey, you know, I kept my promise. I'm bringing you back, this and that. We got a good young team. And at the time, Wayne had a back issue. He missed a bunch of games. And he says, we really need you to fill a role, and we're going to put you back with Luke and this and that. And because the Kings were starting to get a little heat, too, because, you know, the hoopla of the trade had worn off a bit. And now it's like, okay, well, let's try to win a Stanley Cup. And, you know, the whole point of let's expand hockey in the western part of the United States, and the Mighty Ducks had come on board, and the Sharks at San Jose, et cetera. Now it's like, okay, this is all great for hockey, but let's win a cup. And so they were getting some heat on that. And I went to, now on the positive side, we did go to the Stanley Cup Finals. and we lost to the Canadiens. You know, we had a really good team, and it was a very good run for the city and being part of.
I want to ask you a question about Wayne Gretzky, if I may. I played with a lot of superstars, Kaline, Mantle, Barry Bonds, Roger Maris, you name them, I've seen them. What made Gretzky
Bobby
the player
Bonds.
That he thank you very much. There were two Bonds, Bob. I'll explain it to you later. The bottom line is, what made Gretzky so great? I mean, all I've ever heard is what a great, great, great player he was.
Everything.
Well, that's a good question, and that's a complicated answer, other than the fact that he had tremendous ability to anticipate the play. Tremendous ability. Like, sometimes you would watch him. I remember one of the things I enjoyed the most when I came back to L.A., initially, because it's that aura of, oh my gosh, you're going to play with Wayne Gretzky. Is,
sure.
You know, I would be like on the bench. Sometimes I'd have to catch myself that I wasn't expecting. I mean, I'm being a little too dramatic here, but I would watch him. And I'd sometimes watch him, like, you know, the play's on the right side of the ice, and he's suddenly like twirling on the left side. And then all of a sudden, boom, he darts in and the puck comes to him and he's scoring or making a pass to someone for an empty net. He had that ability to see a couple plays
ahead of time.
In advance. And so it was just, you know, a lot of great players have that. Brett Hull, you know, he had the same thing for one timing shots to score, and a lot of great players have had that. But I mean, Gretzky just came, he was just so far ahead, I think, from, you know, when you looked at him physically, you know, when you looked at Mark Messi physically, you go, my gosh, that guy's an Adonis. He's so physically strong.
Right.
You didn't say that with Wayne Gretzky. But when you got on the ice, Gretzky just had the ability to feather a pass, hit the spot, hit the, you know, even skating. You wouldn't say, oh my gosh, you know, you put Fedorov and Gretzky together on a race and Fedorov's gonna beat him. So, yeah. So, but it was, he was just a remarkable talent.
So, Jimmy, personally speaking, I want to ask about your Greek extraction. Have you ever heard of a guy named Dimitrios Kyriakopoulos?
Yes, I have. That's me.
Why don't you tell people who that is? That is you. That's your real name. Now, did you legally change it because it wouldn't fit on your driver's license?
No. That was my grandpa came over, Greek immigrant. He was a chef. He jumped ship in New Orleans, made his way to Detroit because he had some kind of relative. And what do most Greeks do that came to the country at that time? They started a restaurant. They worked in a restaurant and then they started a restaurant. Well, his restaurant was right across the street from Olympia Stadium, Grand River and McGraw. Sure. Right across the street, there was a big church on the corner. And then right next to it was the new Olympia Bar and Grill. So I had heard stories growing up of how Gordie Howe and Ted Lindsay, and they would all go over there. And then when Jack Adams would punish the players, I don't know, they had a bad stretch or whatever, they'd say stuff like, oh, you can't go to Carson's. That was because my grandpa was serving them all and giving them stuff. And it was like, you know, so, and I've actually got some photos of the Olympia being built from my grandpa's restaurant. So a lot of history, but back then, so goes because of discrimination, whatever, my grandpa changed the name and he wanted the most American sounding name he could get. And I'm named after that my grandpa, and James in Greek is Demetrius, still, you know, that's my Greek name. And
so do you speak Greek? Were you raised at home speaking Greek?
Yes. Like I said, my mom's right from Greece. I'm fluent in Greek.
Wow.
Go to Greece.
Wow.
Quite often.
It's all Greek to me, Jimmy. I don't know.
Oh, geez, that's such a bad
It's all Greek to you. So anyway, I never had that name, but he changed it, whatever, in the 30s or something.
And what about you, Eli Zarrett's favorite player, Jimmy? Are you a big fan of Giannis Antetokounmpo now?
Oh, well, if you have any Greek, an ounce of Greek blood, you have to be a fan.
Yeah.
And it was so funny, you want to talk about him. So when we were in Greece last summer, we took the family there. And like I said, my mom's from this island of Rhodes, which is a beautiful Greek island in the Aegean. And the whole country is just mesmerized by Giannis. It's just the one, you just say Giannis and the whole country knows who you're talking about. And it's a very common name. And so we were there, and then he was playing in some international games. So anyways, we come home, and in December, I don't know, my mom, who's, I mean, a lot of my kids play basketball, or grandkids, et cetera. But she like came to me and said, okay, we have to go. I want the whole family to go to see Giannis play. And so we took the whole family in December to Little Caesars to see, and we had probably like 20 people. And then of course I saw half of the Greek community was there as well. And my mom wanted to bake him these Greek cookies and take it to the court side in case he got hungry in between halftime. It doesn't work that way. He says, no, I'm Greek. He'll understand. I said, Mom, trust me, the security is not going to let you down there. So I talked her out of it, but she was.
And Jimmy, by the way, we love cookies.
Yeah, there you go.
Jimmy, thanks so much. Really appreciate you joining. Now, I know you studied to be a financial planner during your career. Is that what you're doing now? Do you you advise people? What's your job?
Yeah, so I've been actually when I was still playing in the NHL, I started getting licensed in various areas, Series 7, Series 6, and I started I ended my career with the Vipers. Which is one of the reasons why I moved from Grosse Pointe to Rochester. And that was a great experience, but it also afforded me the opportunity to kind of intern and learn while I was playing, learn a little bit about the financial services industry. So that's when I got licensed. And I would say I started kind of part-time during those couple seasons I played for them. And then I went into it pretty much full-time afterwards. And I've been doing it for 20 some odd years. And it's been a great experience. I get to help a lot of families and meet a lot of wonderful people. And basically we help people, save for their children's education, save for their retirement, distribute, once they get to retirement, distribute their assets and any risks out there that they need to encounter. So it's been a great career and something that I'm most thrilled about, other than the fact that I really enjoy it, is it gives me a lot of flexibility time-wise so that I can, like I said earlier, I have four kids and I've been at, 98% of their activities, and I wouldn't trade that for anything.
That's great. That's terrific. Hey,
thanks for joining us, spending some time. It's great reliving those historic days of you as a teenager and just beyond. And always enjoyed talking to you when you played here and again today. Thanks again, Jimmy.
Thanks, buddy. No good talking to you.
Thanks for having me. Good luck with this podcast.
Thank you very much. Have a great day.
His nickname on the LA Kings, Jim Fox's former teammate and a longtime broadcaster, says was the governor. They called him the governor because he was so smart and so mature. They thought he'd be the future governor of California one day. Now he's 18 years old. He's sitting on 18 and a rookie. He's sitting on the Kings bus with the great Bob Miller, a Hall of Fame announcer. Jimmy just asked him, so Bob, are you going to be back next year? Miller says, well, I don't know. My contract's up, and I'm not sure we'll be able to come to an agreement. 18-year-old Jimmy Carson says, don't worry. I know some people. We'll get it taken care of for you. That's the kind of guy Jimmy Carson was.
I didn't ask him, but I know he was really a straight shooter. He wasn't a drinker and a partier.
Nice guy.
And I just wondered how that fit in with the culture that, the Bob Probert and the McCarty and the Wings certainly knew how to have a good time on the road and at home as well, but I didn't get into that.
There's two things.
Should have been Hall of Famer.
One is I'd like to give you the Greek national anthem song, but I won't do that one. But on the other hand, the Gretzky thing just amazes me, how everybody says the same thing about him, how he was anticipatory, the way he played the game. And that's what it takes. I mean, there aren't a lot of K-lines in the world. And Kaline was one of those guys.
And lastly, he scored 142 goals his first 3 years. He's the youngest player to ever get 100 goals, even more. Only Wayne Gretzky scored 100 goals at a younger age than Carson. And yet, you take those first 3 years, the last 7 years of his career, he didn't even score as many goals as he did the first three. So that knee injury must have had something to do with it. And it was the culture of the game or just, the things that happen that can affect the way you play. But certainly, if he continued on after those first 3 years, he'd have been a Hall of Famer too.
Well, he was he got hurt.
All right. Well, thanks for joining us, everybody. Had a good time today, and we'll see you again on Thursday for another edition of No Filter Sports.
And everybody, thanks, folks. Please stay safe.